Good morning. It's a great pleasure to welcome people back for the first real oral arguments we've had in a long time. I want to especially recognize our senior colleague, Judge Efron, who has consented to help us out. There is, of course, a vacancy on the court. And as you all know, the President has nominated Mr. Liam Hardy, who presently is with the Justice Department, to succeed our colleague Meg Ryan, whose term expired on 31 July. Mr. Hardy's nomination is out of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he's on the executive calendar, and we hope for a speedy resolution of this. In the meantime, however, we're very grateful to Senior Judge Efron for consenting to sit on these cases. All right, first case is United States versus White. Is the appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the government ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
May it please the court, my name is Major Mary Claire Finnan, and I represent the appellant Petty Officer First Class Jerry White. Chief Judge Stuckey, I respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Special Agent Gerhart did not look for probable cause. Special Agent Gerhart did not find probable cause, and the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he found that Special Agent Gerhart did not act in good faith. We know that Special Agent Gerhart didn't look for probable cause because his idea of probable cause, when he answered trial defense counsel's question of what does probable cause mean to you, was reasonable suspicion. And that is his understanding was corroborated by the shoddy affidavit he presented to the CO and by the total lack of investigative endeavors he undertook. We know that he didn't actually have probable cause or find probable cause because there's barely information in the affidavit to allege that a crime occurred, and there's no affidavit, no information in the affidavit to provide a nexus to the sweeping search that he attempted to conduct. And we know that he didn't act in good faith because no reasonably well-trained officer would put this affidavit in front of a commanding officer and expect anything that came out to be based on probable cause.
He didn't act in good faith. It's one thing to say that the affidavit was lacking in what you need for probable cause. It's another thing to say that he didn't act in good faith, which implies some sort of prevarication or something like that, or at the most, are you saying what, that he was grossly negligent, or what?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, United States versus Leon tells us that the good faith exception doesn't apply when the information in an affidavit is false or reckless, or when a magistrate merely rubber stamps the affidavit, or one of the things I'll be arguing here is that there was insufficient indicia of probable cause in the affidavit.
So therefore, does it fall under the rubber stamp category or what?
Yes, sir.
For Leon.
There was so little, in this case, under these circumstances, because there was so little of indicia of probable cause, that's one prong that I believe Special Agent Gerhart doesn't merit the good faith exception because he provides too little. But also, because he provided too little and there was no evidence presented by the government that this there was no evidence presented by the government that this was not rubber stamped. So the burden was on the government, and they didn't provide the CO to testify.
Keep the mic up. That's much better.
Okay. Yes, sir. So the affidavit here recklessly contained false information, because Special Agent Gerhart said that the appellant sent $10 to Christopher Villanueva, a known child pornography producer.
Yeah. Who is this guy? Villanueva, or what's the other name floating around here?
Hussan Noriega, sir.
Yeah. Right, which one is he? Is he two people? Is he no people? Is he one person? I should and will be asking the government that, but what is he as far as you guys are concerned?
Well, we don't know, Your Honor.
You don't know.
The commanding officer didn't know either.
Yeah.
And because Special Agent Gerhardt made an assumption or a speculation without any justification from the record that Noriega and Villanueva were aliases of the same person. But what we have, in fact, in the HSI report of investigation is that it always refers to them as two separate people. And you'll see that on page 3 of the HSI report of investigation, where it says that Noriega is one of Villanueva's identified money collectors. And the rest of the report of investigation never mentions either of the two names as being an alias of the other. The search authorization here was rubber-stamped because the affidavit lacks anything the commanding officer could rely on to find probable cause, and the government provided no details of the meeting where the CO signed the CAS to show that it wasn't rubber-stamped. And finally, the affidavit had insufficient indicia of probable cause because there was simply not enough information given to the commanding officer in this case. I'd like to talk about that first. Special Agent Gerhardt provided an affidavit that relied on stereotypes, not evidence, and an attenuated connection between the appellant and the known child pornography producer. In 2015, an HSI agent contacted Christopher Villanueva in the Philippines and tried to buy live-streamed child pornography. Villanueva put him in touch with one of his money collectors, Hussan Noriega. And it's Noriega who's transfers were investigated by HSI. And when they investigated, they found that the appellant in this case had sent a single transfer to Hussan Noriega, not Christopher Villanueva.
That was the $10.
Yes, Your Honor. That transaction occurred on May 16, 2015. This search occurred 22 months later in March of 2017. That transaction occurred while the accused was living in Norfolk, Virginia, and this search occurred while he was stationed in Atsugi, Japan, of his off-base home. Moreover, the money was never picked up by the recipient, so Noriega never picked up the $10, and it was eventually returned to the appellant in this case. As a military judge said, that fairly implies that the appellant received nothing for his money.
Counsel, with HSI, the investigators, they were pursuing this. They were informed that the transaction would be $100 and they had to pay $55 up front. What does that tell us about a $10 transaction by your client?
Your Honor, I think all the evidence that Special Agent Gerhardt did have from the HSI report of investigation tried to make this transaction look just like Special Agent the HSI Special Agent's transaction. But that is at least one significant difference, is the amount of money they paid or attempted to pay in his case. So that's yet another area that this is likely a very different transaction. And there was just no information provided, you know, to give context to this transaction or show how it was like the HSI agent's transaction. I think it was even on different platforms, money transfer platforms, Your Honor. The second set of facts that we have here is equally troublesome, and that's all the transactions to the Philippines. That does not add much to this affidavit because none of those transactions were to known recipients. The affidavit doesn't even say how many recipients there were, making it indistinguishable from a sailor who supports family abroad. If this is the basis for probable cause, it's open season to search sailors who support family in other countries.
Well, could it also be your position that these transactions could have been for lawful adult pornography or eBay transactions, Etsy, Craigslist?
Yes, anything? Your Honor.
It doesn't need to be simply a transaction supporting someone in the Philippines, but they could be lawful transactions, even if they might be viewed by some as being sordid.
Yes, Your Honor. And that makes this very different from a case like Clayton, where someone was a member of a known child pornography group, where you can think of no reason. Someone who wasn't interested in child pornography belonged to a child pornography internet group. But this case is different. You know, Hussan Noriega is a human being, and there are plenty of people who have lawful businesses who also have illegal businesses, and we don't know anything else about Noriega. We don't know if he had other businesses that for which he would collect money.
Counsel, is your position that the only thing that makes the nexus between your client and all of this, these transactions with Noriega, is this $10 transaction, or do you concede that there are other things that connect them, they're just not enough?
I concede that there are other things that Special Agent Gerhardt could have looked into that might have gotten him closer to probable cause.
No, I understand, but as far as what he did look into, or in your case, from your point of view, didn't look into, but what I'm asking you is right now, based on everything on the record, is your position that the only nexus is the $10 transaction?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the only nexus. The transactions, because they weren't traced, are of minimal value to this. Those transactions were old. They were between almost 5 years and 10 months before the search. The bulk of those transactions took place in a different, while the accused was stationed in a different country.
So your position is that under Nieto and our other cases, that's simply not enough to establish that contraband or evidence will be found in the place they search?
Yes, Your Honor. So under the sort of two prongs of the probable cause analysis, you have to believe that a crime was committed. And here we don't really have enough to even get there. And that's what makes this case so much weaker than the affidavits presented in Blackburn, in Perkins, in Nieto, in Clayton, in any of the other cases this court has considered. We don't have enough information to say a crime is committed, and we don't even get close to providing a nexus to the place that was searched.
Counsel, in terms of using the word transaction, as you were just doing, doesn't that in some ways state more than occurred here? There was, your client sent $10. That $10 was not collected, and there's nothing in the record that indicates that there was any transfer of any goods in exchange for that $10. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's actually the same for all the other transactions that are listed in the affidavit. Those were collected, but we have no idea and can only speculate as to what.
But in this particular one, as Judge Sparks was saying, this is the only connection to Noriega / Villanueva. It was for $10. That $10 was never collected.
Yes, Your Honor. And then the third fact that Special Agent Gerhardt relied on was this sweeping statement that Tegucigalpa City is this place that's a hotbed of child prostitution and child sex trafficking. When Special Agent Gerhardt was asked about why he put that in the affidavit, he answered, sort of gave an answer about all of the Philippines having this problem with child sexual exploitation. That's in the record at page 20. And there's certainly.
Could you repeat? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I didn't understand what you said. All Tegucigalpa City, or however you pronounce it, all the what?
So when the trial counsel in the case asked Special Agent Gerhardt, Your Honor, what the significance of Tegucigalpa City, why he put that in his affidavit, he gave a very broad, vague answer about the Philippines having a problem with child sex exploitation, sort of assuming that the Philippines has more of a...
Good enough. Thank you.
Counsel, is your point there that information is insufficient to establish probable cause, or is it your point that it was improper to offer that information?
My position is that it is of very minimal relevance in this case with his few facts and his lack of personal understanding of that. He was relying on a stereotype. So in this case, it would be improper, sir. Your Honor, I'm not saying that it would always be improper to rely on a geographic location, Your Honor.
if something has minimal relevance, why is it improper? You gave two answers. First, you suggested that it had minimal relevance, which might undermine the probable cause. Then you suggested that it was improper in this case to offer that information for context.
Yes, Your Honor, and I base that on Special Agent Gerhardt's understanding of why this was in the affidavit, and that's why it was improper in this case, because his understanding was this broad stereotype that he relied on.
And in your brief, have you identified this as improper information?
I did not identify it as improper, Your Honor.
You. Counsel, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that this case was indistinguishable from Perkins because, largely because the search authorization request was sent to the SJA. What do we know total about what the SJA said and to the commander, and then also what Special Agent Gerhardt knew? And one question I had in particular is in footnote 53 of your supplement, you cite the Article 32 testimony. Was that part of the information before the trial judge in ruling on the motion?
It was, Your Honor. To answer that second question, the Article 32 investigation was an enclosure to the defense's motion. This case is very different from Perkins in that we don't know any substantive conversation that the SJA had with the agent, if there was any substantive conversation with the agent, if the SJA even reviewed it, really, because what we have here is the agent saying that he sent it to legal and that he knows that legal or the SJA was in the room with the CO before he walked in and gave his brief, but he doesn't know if he was there. He didn't have any knowledge of whether he gave the sort of imprimatur of probable cause to the CO before he signed it. That's all just based on speculation on the lower court's part.
The lower court seemed to think, there was very little in that paragraph, but it almost appeared that the lower court believed it was enough that he just sent it to the SJA, even without knowing about whether there was any communication. Do you agree with that it would be enough just to send it?
I do agree with that, Your Honor. This is taking the Perkins, what Perkins was made to do, which was protect proactive agents and make sure we're not holding them back, and kind of reward that agent in Perkins who did everything right. She recognized she had a problem with probable cause, so she talked to three attorneys before she conducted the search. She stopped her search midway through and got another search authorization, all those things we want agents to do and we want to reward them. But this agent is abusing the process because he knows it's a check in the box. And that's all he could give the court when he testified, and when he testified at the Article 32, he could not remember any details of his meeting with the CO, what the CO asked him, or having any conversation with the SJA. And the government in this case starved the record because they provided neither of those people to testify. They relied entirely on Special Agent Gerhardt.
And Special Agent Gerhardt, could he even identify the SJA?
No, he did not remember who the SJA was by the time the Article 39 occurred, sir. So that again speaks to how little import the SJA input was to him, assuming there was some, which is only an assumption. This case is also different in Perkins in that this was a post-Nieto search. So this court had a clear rule that had been published before the search in this case. Nieto was published in February of 2017. This was in March of 2017. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
You may conclude.
We ask that you uphold the military judge's ruling in this case.
Greg, any questions? Any questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Thank you. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Joshua Fiveson. Along with Lieutenant Colonel Nick Gannon, I represent the United States.
Could you speak a little louder? And
yes, Your Honor.
As Senator Thurman said, speak into the machine.
Yes, Your Honor. So, 2 points demonstrate that the military judge abused his discretion by failing to properly analyze the good faith exception. First, the military judge's conclusion relied on a degree of scrutiny long held inappropriate for affidavits and inconsistent with the purpose of the Fourth Amendment. And second, the military judge's conclusion conflated the nexus required for the good faith exception and that for probable cause, thereby silently reviving the standard rejected in Perkins. Now, before I get into those 2 points, I'd like to briefly contour the scope of the military judge's actual ruling. The military judge here held that the good faith exception did not apply because, in his view, the affidavit was facially deficient, i.e. bare bones. And though I intend to address the points my colleague has raised, namely recklessness and rubber stamping, neither of which were actually addressed by the military judge, I would encourage the court respectfully to first focus on the actual scope of the ruling. With that in mind, as I mentioned, there are 2 points that evidence the abuse of discretion here. First, the military judge's analysis relied on a degree of hyper-technical scrutiny that's unsuited for affidavits. And in doing so, he failed to weigh relevant considerations under MRE 311C3B.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it hyper-technical scrutiny to say that a single 10-buck transaction, which never was consummated, is enough to give you probable cause when seen on the background of some city in the Philippines that has a gamey reputation, and two guys or one guy or no guy, Villanueva and Noriega, who are they, number one? Does the government have an opinion? Does it matter?
Yes, Your Honor. So first, the military judge found this fact that Villanueva, Noriega, may have been an alias of Villanueva, but viewed even in the light most favorable to appellant, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Okay.
Even if the two are different, he was a known clearinghouse for an actively investigated child pornography ring. So though any fact here viewed
in isolation... Well, what was a known clearinghouse? Villanueva, Noriega, Axis, or what? What are you talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. So even if we were to assume that Noriega is a different person, we know from the Homeland and Security investigation that Villanueva directs his customers to send payments to Noriega. He is a known clearinghouse. And I would add that none of these facts are to be viewed in isolation. Each one is a brick, ultimately, in the foundation.
Okay, so he sent 10 bucks to this guy, for which he got nothing. That's enough?
In isolation, Your Honor? No, but there was more than that.
Yeah, what is there? There's the gamey reputation of the town. There's the gamey reputation of these two guys.
Well, Your Honor, if I were to itemize it briefly, appellant sent nearly 200 transfers to the Philippines.
To the Philippines, to whom?
Well, Your Honor, a country to which he had no known travel, and over 50% of those transfers went to a single city, Taguig, which had a reputation.
But in terms of the Chief Judge's question, to whom? Not to where, to whom?
Yes, Your Honor. So
we know,
the only one that we know, Your Honor, is the only one that was known who received it, was to Noriega. But again,
The $10.
Yes, Your Honor.
All these other transactions went to the Philippines. What, half of them went to this gamey place?
Over half of them went to a single city.
City, okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
But we don't know anything about who they went to or what the quid pro quo was
or
what he got for the money or anything like that?
That's right. We don't know. But again, probable cause, and even less so the good faith exception, doesn't require certainty, as this court has held consistently.
Well, I'm not asking for certainty, but it sounds like this is a whole long way from certainty. But go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. This is a long way from certainty.
Yeah.
However, what this does support is a fair probability of a crime in a particular place. And I would highlight the fact that the good faith exception, again, doesn't turn on any sense of certainty. It's whether or not the agent has a reasonable belief and a substantial basis for probable cause, realizing that the court only gets there once it has concluded that there wasn't probable cause. And I would point out
the CCA said that if the agent, Special Agent Gerhardt, had done more investigation, he could have developed additional facts and so forth. So why wouldn't Special Agent Gerhardt have known that he should have done more investigation to nail down all these problems in terms of, is Noriega an alias for Villanueva? Where were these other transactions over the course of 4 years? To whom did they go and things like that? Why wouldn't that be apparent to the special agent that his own affidavit was problematic?
Well, Your Honor, on these facts, obviously the agent did not do the additional investigation. But I would point the court to Clayton. In fact, Senior Judge Efron, as you pointed out in Clayton, these types of questions, the rhetorical kind of questions focusing on the failings of an investigation, aren't even properly directed to the search authority. So by focusing in on this, the military judge charged the agent with an obligation not expected of the search authority and certainly not compelled by the Fourth Amendment.
Isn't Clayton distinguishable in terms of it was a known ring of child sex predators? Here, we don't have that, do we?
I would disagree, Judge Olson. So on these facts, we know that appellant sent one transfer directly to a known and actively investigated ring for child pornography and viewed alongside the host of other transfers to the city that is the headquarters of that child pornography ring. And as well, the Homeland Security investigation did note specifically that Villanueva had a host of collectors for the money. So again, these facts viewed together are consistent with this pattern that Homeland Security knows the child pornography ring operates within. So viewed together, again, this provides the agent with a substantial basis to believe that probable cause existed, even if that was mistaken. As this court identified in Blackburn, deficiencies in the agent's legal reasoning are not dispositive under the good faith exception.
Now, in terms of it being a child sex ring, was there anything in the affidavit that showed whether Special Agent Gerhardt had looked into whether Villanueva / Noriega was involved in lawful adult pornography or other lawful conduct where the $10 could have been exchanged for a lawful item?
No, Your Honor. But, again, viewed together with the host of other facts known, the agent had enough to believe reasonably that there was a substantial basis for probable cause, again, acknowledging that that belief may have proven mistaken. And I would just
Counsel, what's the position of the government as to whether this did or did not constitute probable cause? That is, the information limited to the investigation identifying Villanueva and his relationship with Noriega in terms of child pornography and the sending of money to Noriega. Is that sufficient or not sufficient to establish probable cause in this case? In other words, does the government rely only on the good faith exception, or does the government have a position with respect to probable cause?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that this was sufficient for probable cause. However, I've not argued that only because the court below did find that, and of course there wasn't a cross appeal here, but the United States maintains the position that this was sufficient evidence for probable cause, realizing that probable cause does not deal in certainties, but rather turns on whether or not there's a fair probability of a crime in a particular place. So the United States' position is that there was probable cause, but the court need not even rest on that because there is no question, or there can be no question, that the good faith exception applied here because the agent reasonably believed that there was probable cause based on the facts.
Now, the manual for court... Manual for courts, Marshall, has language which suggests that the issuing authority, not suggests, but states that the issuing authority has to have a substantial basis for finding probable cause. In Carter, in 2001, this court interpreted that in a manner that, in effect, read out that requirement from the rule. What's the government's position as to whether the rule governs or whether the Carter case and its progeny govern in the case before us?
Your Honor, it's the United States' position that per Perkins, the Carter regime maintains. So the point is, under 311C3B, an agent can reasonably believe in a probable cause, reasonably believe in a substantial basis, even if it's proven that the search authority did not actually have a substantial basis. The Hoffman regime that was rejected in Perkins essentially elided that distinction and said any time that there is no substantial basis, an agent cannot reasonably believe in a substantial basis. So this court rejected that in Perkins, and the United States, of course, concurs in that assessment.
In 2001, that doctrine was announced in the Carter case, and the President has amended the manual a number of times since then. What do we make of that, that the President, notwithstanding Carter, has not removed that language and the requirement for the magistrate to have a substantial basis for the probable cause determination?
Your Honor, it's the United States' position that we are still living in the post-Perkins world, and to the extent that this case, the granted issue, pertains only to the good faith exception, it's the United States' position that the agent here had a reasonable belief in a substantial basis, thereby satisfying the good faith exception, consistent with Perkins, which endorsed the reasoning of Carter. Now,
counsel, isn't this awfully close to the exception swallowing the rule? I mean, if all we've got here is, yeah, I think that's enough, however vague and ill-supported, is this a case of the exception swallowing the rule?
So no, Your Honor. And to the extent that the exception is in any sense broadly applied, that's a direct product of the Supreme Court.
I realize that.
Yes, Your Honor.
I realize that. And maybe the Supreme Court intended for the exception to swallow the rule, although they didn't overrule Weeks. So.
Yes, Your Honor. I would simply point out that, though, at the margins, certainly there may be cases that present more pause. This case is not that. Here, appellant sent nearly 200 transfers to the Philippines, over 50% of which went to a single city known for child sex trafficking crimes and headquarters to a child pornography ring, which appellant also happened to directly transfer money to.
Shouldn't he have done a little more dig? I mean, if that's it sounds like promising soil, but he didn't stick his spade in it.
Yes, Your Honor.
He just said, oh, yeah, he sent a bunch of money to somebody, we know not whom, in this town with a gamey reputation for we know not what in exchange.
Well, I would add, Your Honor, that the Federal Circuit courts have engaged in similar reasoning. And to the extent here that we're focused on what was a reasonable belief for an agent, to the extent that circuits agree, it is reasonable. I would point the court to Tusset, for example. In Tusset, there were three low-money transfers to the Philippines. And the Federal Circuit Court directly pointed out the Philippines was known for child sex trafficking and allowed that to weigh on their Fourth Amendment inquiry. It was certainly not the only factor.
Well, no. I mean, you could send the money and get lumpia in exchange, but, I don't know.
So how far should we go with that? What if someone was having transactions with Medellin? Does it mean it was involved in drugs? Lagos, it means it was some type of fraud. City in Romania, it's involved computer hacking. I mean, what do we do with this idea that a city of 800,000 people has a quote-unquote reputation as compared to, let's say, detectives in the city saying, in this four-block area, this is a hub of narcotics trafficking?
Well, Your Honor, I would first note that the nature of the criminal activity rather than the geographic bounds drives that kind of inquiry. So the point is a large area can be known for criminal activity just as a small area can be known. And it turns really on the nature of the crime. But to your question, no, simply sending money to Colombia isn't enough. But viewed on the backdrop similar to here, where if there was also a transfer directly to, let's say, a known cartel, that colors what the other transactions fairly support. And again, this is not a discussion about probable cause, which does not deal in certainty. This is a discussion about what an agent reasonably perceives, whether or not there's a crime in a certain place. So viewed together, the totality of the facts and the circumstances, it supports the reasonable belief. It may ultimately prove untrue, and in fact, any time we're having a discussion about the good faith exception, it has proven untrue, at least in the sense of meeting probable cause. But that doesn't drive the analysis. Were that the case, it would revive the Hoffman standard that this Court rejected in Perkins.
Can I ask specifically about that? Perkins said that 311b3 is satisfied if the law enforcement official had an objectively reasonable belief that the magistrate had a substantial basis for determining the existence of probable cause. If a substantial basis does not exist, what is the government's theory of how someone could have an objectively reasonable belief that it did exist, that there was a substantial basis? Whether there's a substantial basis or not is a question of law. And what is the government's theory of what would constitute an objectively reasonable basis for believing that there was a substantial basis if there is not, in fact, a substantial basis? Is it talking to counsel? Is it sending the search authorization to counsel without finding anything more? Or is it something else?
So a number of points in response, Your Honor. First, I would note an objectively reasonable belief doesn't turn on the precise contours of the law. And that really is the delta there that matters, that makes it logically consistent. So whereas a substantial basis does not occur based on the intricacies of the legal framework expected in that space, an agent who is not a trained lawyer can have an objectively reasonable belief in a substantial basis that nonetheless did not exist based on the facts. This is the common sense inquiry. This is the flexible standard compelled by Leon and really under the chorus of precedent in this space. So that resolves the cognitive dissonance there. Now, to your second point about the involvement of a staff judge advocate, which I understood that as being some of the point, Judge Max, here I would respectfully encourage the Court to focus on that as you did in Blackburn. Again, it's not what is the degree of involvement necessarily, though that can bear on reasonable reliance. In Blackburn, this Court specifically said the record reflected no objection from the staff judge advocate who had participated in the process. That's exactly what we have here. And though certainly there could have been 15 lawyers, the point is it's not determinative the number of lawyers or really there's no, it's a sliding scale as to what participation there is with a lawyer. The fact remains that once a trained lawyer has participated in the process, that impacts a law enforcement agent's reasonable belief in the outcome of that process, which is really what the good faith exception is focused in on. And we have that in spades. And what I would note also, Judge Max, this highlights fairly well that by focusing on the very type of questions that you, Judge Efron, kind of rejected in Clayton, the military judge didn't ask any of these relevant questions. The military judge didn't focus on whether or not the affidavit fairly presented conflicts and gaps in the evidence, as it did in Carter. He did not focus on whether or not there was any objection in the record from the staff judge advocate, and did not focus on whether or not there was reliable information underlying the investigation or the depth of the agent's experience, as is considered by the really almost all of the circuits. That's the principal reason why the military judge abused his discretion in the first instance. Seeing that I'm almost out of time, however, I would like to briefly address the points raised by my colleague, but not addressed by the military judge. As for recklessness statements, there were none. I would also point out that from Blackburn, we know that this is a question of fact, and I would respectfully suggest that the lack of any findings of fact is, in a sense, revealing. Also, there was no Franks hearing, which is equally telling. But assuming this status of fact is not preclusive to engage in this inquiry, the claims here are simply not founded. Appellants claim that there's a distinction between Villanueva and Noriega, was not raised at trial and was waived. In fact, trial defense counsel conceded that they were one and the same. So there can be no claim of recklessness in that sense. As to the reputation of the city, trial defense counsel also conceded that it was relevant. You can see that at record 43 to 44. And as to the second point, the rubber stamping point, which was also not addressed by the military judge, that was waived. As we know from Perkins, specifically note 13, I believe, Judge Maggs, you had written that an appellant has an obligation to challenge in the first instance under 315 Delta whether or not a search authority is in fact competent. And we know that competence turns on impartiality. and where there has been rubber stamping, a search authority is no longer impartial. So in that respect, the 311C3A through C are best viewed not as mutually exclusive spheres of disqualifying conditions, but rather three overlapping spheres. So put a bit more simply, if a search authority has rubber stamped, they are no longer competent. It's disqualified under both senses. But here, trial defense counsel affirmatively conceded that the search authority was competent. So that is waived. Now, Chief Judge Stuckey, I see that my time is expired. May I conclude briefly?
Please conclude your
argument. Chief Judge, may I follow up on that?
Everett has a question.
I'm not clear on the relationship between rubber stamping and impartiality. That is that phrase rubber stamping necessarily mean a general incompetence or a specific lack of impartiality in the case, or could it be simply an error?
So I believe you're in a sense alluding to the distinction Judge Olson raised in his dissent in Perkins between what is sometimes seen as procedural rubber stamping and substantive rubber stamping. But the point is the same under both, where a search authority has stamped something, said good to go. Under Charlie, the question is whether or not the agent can rely on the issuance of the search authorization. And in that regard, the answer is no, where it's been rubber stamped, because they are not impartial. And an agent cannot reasonably rely on the product of a partial process. That's not how it works. So that's the extent to which
they're alleged. How does the agent know that there's rubber stamping?
Your Honor, so that is an interesting question. But as this Court has actually pointed out in various cases, the lack of knowledge that there has been rubber stamping is influential in deciding whether or not Charlie is prohibitive.
No, I understand that. But in terms of saying that somehow there's a lack of impartiality in there that has been waived in this case, I'm not quite following that.
The point is simple, Your Honor. So appellant was asked for specificity and affirmatively conceded that there was no challenge to the search authority's competence. And we know from Perkins Note 13 that a challenge to competence, which is in part based on partiality, whether or not they are neutral, is to be made in the first instance. So
I understand that, but I'm not following why that necessarily was clear to the parties in discussing the issue of competence, that impartiality would somehow be at issue in the same context as opposed to error with respect to recklessness.
Well, Your Honor, my response would be simply that this Court's inquiry into waiver thus far has not looked into necessarily appellant's conception of what the precise contours of the law are. And here we know that they affirmatively conceded that the search authority was competent. And we know from Perkins that competence turns on impartiality in part, and to the extent that there's an affirmative concession there, there can be no rubber stamping arguments here.
Thank you.
So to conclude, Chief Judge Stuckey, appellant asks, pending any questions from the Court, appellant asks that this Court endorse the military judge's preference for hyper-technical invalidation of an affidavit over the common-sense reasoning urged by the Supreme Court and this Court's precedent. The United States would respectfully ask that you decline. Even if the affidavit here failed to establish probable cause, it was not bare bones and therefore supported the agent's reasonable belief in a substantial basis. As such, the NMCCA correctly concluded that the military judge abused his discretion, and this Court should affirm.
Thank you. Rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd first like to address opposing counsel's argument about what the defense counsel in this case conceded. She conceded under prong A that the commanding officer was competent. This Court has said that rubber stamping is an argument under prong C. She did not concede that. In fact, she said that in her motion, and a lot of the questioning in this case was about rubber stamping. What exactly was the process here? That the government did not provide enough facts to fully flesh this out is a problem with the government's case, not with the defense's case, Your Honor.
Was waiver argued below at all?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
The commanding officer in this case knew and relied on one thing, and that was wrong, and that was the connection between Villanueva and Noriega, or the connection between the appellant and Noriega, not the connection between the appellant and Villanueva. The counsel, my opposing counsel and I have both relied on many of the facts from the HSI report of investigation. That's very telling because the affidavit did not cite any of these facts, and we have no facts to show that the agent shared more than he put in the affidavit, because he put in the affidavit what he thought was important, and he testified at the Article 32 and at the 39A to what he thought was important. And he said he's provided a summary and a synopsis to the CO, and that from that, the military judge could fairly infer, and in fact did, that he provided the CO what is in fact in the affidavit. So that's what we can rely on in this case, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you to respond to Clarkson's statement that for the purpose of good faith, it was sufficient to make it objective because there was no objection from legal counsel. In other words, that it wouldn't necessarily be required that legal counsel specifically say it was okay, but that under Blackburn, it would be significant that there was simply no objection from the SJA. Could you respond to that argument?
I don't think there's evidence in the record to support that, Your Honor. We've all assumed there was no objection because the commanding officer did, in fact, sign the affidavit. The search authorization, but we don't know that the SJA did actually say there was probable cause in this case. And there's, again, the SJA and the commanding officer did not testify. Even if the SJA did review the affidavit, I see my time's expired.
Please answer the question.
Thank you. Even if he did, this case is not one around the margins. This case was so far below the standard of what an agent could objectively, reasonably believe, whether he provided a substantial basis for the commanding officer. Something like Perkins that just had an error in one specific, the nexus requirement, a specific legal assessment of how close a nexus you needed, and really a mistake of fact. You know, that cell phone was not in the same state as the search in that case. But here you have just a completely deficient affidavit in every area. To set in the opposing counsel's argument was a reasonable suspicion case. It was a border search. That's the only case that counsel could come up with these transactions being the basis for probable cause.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 10:45 so that necessary viral precautions may be engaged in.